So thanks, Mark, for the introduction, and I thank the organizers for having me here. What I'm going to... Can that be heard? Is that close? Okay, you just show up. What I'm going to talk about is joint work with Uli Bunke, and it's available on the archive. So secondary invariants, I'd like... So there are many things which go under this name. It's not a precise mathematical concept, so I decided rather than to drop very many names, I would go through some very classical occurrence of a secondary invariant through some detail, because I was happy when preparing this talk to find there is such a secondary invariant in the classical literature, and in fact it does reveal quite a number of the features I will be talking about later more generally. And the paper I'm referring to is Milner's paper on manifolds homeomorphic to the seventh sphere. So that is a famous paper because in it Milner for the first time proves the existence of exotic spheres. In this particular case he constructs a closed oriented seven-dimensional manifold which is homeomorphic but not diffeomorphic to the seventh sphere. So this manifold is constructed as the total space of a sphere bundle, and it is recognized to be a sphere topologically using Morse theory. And what I'd like to remind you of in some more detail is the invariant Milner uses to tell this manifold apart from the seventh sphere. So we're looking for an invariant of closed seven-dimensional manifold, which must be more subtle than just depending on the underlying topological space, if it's to detect an exotic sphere. So the way we do this, and this is an example, so I just called this Milner's lambda invariant because that's the letter used in the paper. I mean, that's not a standard name, I just call it that for now. And that is a secondary invariant, and I explain its constructions in detail now. So if that's a secondary invariant, there better be a primary one first, and there is. Namely, the primary invariant is the left-hand side of the equation labeled star, and this is an invariant not of seven manifolds, but of closed eight-dimensional manifolds. So let B be a closed-oriented manifold of dimension 8, and then consider associated with this manifold this primary invariant, which is the left-hand side of the equation star, 2 times this characteristic number, the square of the first Pontryagin number, minus the signature. So that is definitely some invariant of this manifold, and it is clearly an integer. There is a vanishing theorem for this invariant, which is the equation star, which says that this integer is not just some integer, but it's divisible by 7. That's a vanishing result, because it says it's 0 mod 7. The reason for this vanishing result is the Hertzsprung signature theorem, written as equation 1, rearranged trivially. So equation 1 is Hertzsprung's signature theorem, which immediately implies 2, and this is a general philosophy. Whenever there is a vanishing theorem for a primary invariant, there arises a secondary invariant. And here, concretely, this happens by cutting the manifold B open along a hypersurface. So assume B comes about, I could try to use this lightsaber, but I couldn't read it yesterday, so probably I will try not to use it too much. So assume B comes about by cutting, by gluing 2 eight-dimensional manifolds B1 and B2 along a common boundary M, and let's assume M has vanishing third and fourth cohomology for technical reasons, and this is certainly no bad if in the end we want to speak about spheres, because then it's very easy to see that the ingredients of the primary invariant, the signature, and the square of the first Pontryagin number are additive under gluing. And that immediately implies that finally I defined this lambda invariant M in the last displayed equation by taking the primary invariant on any zero bordism of M. It's worthwhile to read over this sheet again in the reverse direction. So that is the geometric description of the lambda invariant is as follows. Given a oriented seven-dimensional manifold, choose a zero bordism, which you know exists for kind of abstract reasons. It's a famous homotropy computation, of course, knowing all of oriented bordism, and MSO7 is zero. So choose a zero bordism, and then apply a very basic primary invariant to the zero bordism. The fact that this is well-defined, independent of the choice of the zero bordism, is an index theorem. It's a consequence of an index theorem. So that is how Milner's invariant arises. Okay, and then of course then Milner goes on to construct a manifold which has non-vanishing lambda invariant, and which hence cannot be the boundary of anything. In particular, it cannot be a sphere, And you can also now understand why Milnert has chosen his manifold to be the total space of a sphere bundle, because then it is very easy to get at a zero Bohrism. You just fill in the disk bundle. In general, I'm now going to pursue a question which Milnert did not ask and did not have to ask, namely, how can I compute the invariant lambda of M just in terms of M? Because while this homotopy theoretic result tells you there is always some zero Bohrism, if the manifold is given to you geometrically as a hypersurface or whatever, you will not be able to come up easily with a zero Bohrism unless you have made a clever choice from the very outset and you're looking at the total space of a sphere bundle or something. So we'll now talk about an intrinsic description of this invariant. So you can ask this. You have an invariant of this manifold. How to compute it just in terms of the manifold M, because you don't know how to write down a zero Bohrism. I will do this. So this sheet contains an undergraduate exercise in differential geometry, which I'm doing for you for later reference. So the equation 1 prime is the signature theorem, if you so want, for manifolds with boundary. It's a special case of the Atiyah-Pardoli-Singer index theorem. And it tells you that, now I'm starting out more generally with an oriented eight-dimensional manifold which is allowed to have some boundary M, and I still have a signature theorem which expresses the signature of B as the characteristic number just as before, but there is a correction term from the boundary which is an eta invariant. In general, eta invariants, I should say this talk draws upon differential geometry, global analysis, and homotopy theory, and of course I want to stress the homotopy theory. But it's interesting that there is some analysis, so I want to say it once. We will have analysis appearing all the time through the eta invariants of certain elliptic differential operators. I won't even bother to say what that is. But it's interesting, it's there, and it's okay, that's it. We have this signature theorem, and now comes this undergraduate exercise. I want to rewrite this equation to get an expression for my lambda invariant, which only depends on M. And what this page explains in detail is how to rewrite the summand involving the square of the first Pontryagin number. So what you do is I've chosen geometry somehow. These nabla TB, these are connections corresponding to the choices of metrics, which then via Chern-Weyl theory leads to specific differential form representing these cohomology classes P1 squared and similarly. So I talk about P1 for a while, and the problem is the first integral doesn't have to be an integer because the forms appearing are not necessarily supported in the interior of B. So I just, for example, now I talk about the first Pontryagin class, this form may not be supported in the interior, but restricted to the boundary, it's exact, because H4 of M is zero by assumption. So I integrate the form on the boundary, obtaining this form rho, which I then smear out over the manifold using a smooth partition of unity subordinate to a collar. Then it's an immediate application of Stokes' theorem to get this just the final equation on the page, which expresses the lambda invariant somehow, and one of the terms which was extrinsic before made reference to B is now intrinsic and makes reference only to M. So there is one term left, and I will be more sketchy with this one. So this formula is the one you've just seen. The first term in this formula is obviously not intrinsic to M, it depends on B, but this can also be made intrinsic somehow, and you get this final formula for lambda. And you see, by the way, it is displayed that I don't really want you to read it at all. I just want you to note that some more choices, and there is even an additional elliptic operator, depending on the choice of the spin C structure and so on, leads to an intrinsic description of this lambda invariant. So this only makes references to the manifold M itself. And incidentally, observe that this fantasy expression in square brackets there, which is just some real number a priori, we do in fact know that it is an integer and that its residue class mod 7 is independent of all the auxiliary choices. So this I will refer to as the intrinsic or the analytic description of this invariant. Okay, this ends the somehow extended example, and I will start to talk about our contribution, properly speaking. I will first have an overview. There is a constructive and a computational part. So what do we construct? The main player, and actually the only new thing around, is an invariant of string Borgism. So M string 4M minus 1 is the same thing as pi 4 minus 1, 4M minus 1 of M 08, just to use all words that come to my mind. So this is the group of closed string manifolds of dimension 4M minus 1, Borgism classes. And for perspective, note that unlike many other Borgism theories, these groups are not known explicitly. They're known through for some small m, but not in general. And we are going to construct an invariant, which is just to say a group homomorphism on the string Borgism. And I'm always going to talk about dimension congruent to 3 mod 4 and using spectral invariants. So we will get this invariant by writing down something similar to the analytic expression of Milner's lambda invariant. And it will be a secondary invariant associated to the Witten genus, which is roughly to say, you will see this all more precisely in a minute, which is roughly to say that what was this, in Milner's case, was the left-hand side of the equation star, this primary invariant, P1 squared minus the signature, that is going to be replaced by the Witten genus. Okay, this is of course, I will tell you more about string Borgism in general in a minute, but in any event, this is a finite abelian group. So if you make some geometric construction, in fact, you have a fair chance of just constructing the zero homomorphism. So this is no good unless we can compute something. So we will be able to evaluate, in fact, quite completely this invariant, this homomorphism B analytic, at least restricted to a subgroup A4M minus 1, which is the kernel of the canonical map from string to spin Borgism. There are some interesting homotopy theoretic questions related to this group. I will address these in more detail later on. But for now, observe it's quite natural to look at this group because in Milner's example, there was this kind of complicated expression, intrinsic expression for the lambda invariant, which became very simple once you had some zero Borgism. In Milner's case, you always knew there was such a thing. In our case, we don't even know this. We want our string manifold to be zero Borgism as a spin manifold. So to be in the kernel, and since we have no clue whether or not that happens often or not, we just put it in as an assumption. So we restrict our invariant to this kernel, and then we will be able to equate it with some other straightforward constructions, and the final one of them, B top, will be a purely homotopy theoretic construction, which will then lead to a complete calculation as follows. So to say we have a computation, in the first place doesn't make sense anyways, because what would it mean to explicitly compute a group homomorphism defined on a group you don't know? I mean, these elements don't have names, and so you can, if it was the zero homomorphism, you could name that, but that's not what I'm talking about. So the computation will take the following form. There will be a commutative diagram as displayed. Now TMF is, of course, TMF. Sigma is the what I will refer to variably as the sigma orientation or the refined Witten genus. It's the E-infinity map constructed by Andor, Hopkins, and Resk. And okay, there will be such a factorization. And this invariant BTMF, this will be evaluated completely explicitly. And that does make sense because unlike string Borgism, the homotopy of TMF is, of course, completely known. Okay, and in particular, this will imply non-triviality of our construction in infinitely many dimensions just by looking at the computations we will perform for BTMF coupled with the result of Hopkins and Mahovald that sigma is actually surjective. So whenever our BTMF detects something, we know we actually detect some string manifold and not just something in the homotopy of TMF. Oh, yeah, I want to. That is some group which will be defined the very moment its definition is inevitable. No, it's just, it would be, I think it's just two sheets away. It will be defined in a minute. It's just the natural recipient for our invariant, but it can be defined more in a more motivated way once I've talked a little more about the invariant. Sorry, I meant to say that earlier. Okay, I mean, this diagram is in fact another way of thinking about our contribution, because you can also read it as, I mean, this sigma orientation, that's of course a fantastic piece of homotropy theory, but it is homotropy theory. And I mean, the Witten genus is of course, the Witten genus is of course, I mean, we heard in Matthew's talk a lot of it. I mean, it's interesting for all its ramification to geometry and physics, I guess. And this refined thing, the sigma orientation, I wouldn't know of any such interpretation. So you can also think of our contribution as providing a geometric interpretation, at least of parts of the sigma orientation. And it's only parts because it's only defined on the subgroup, and it's in the end you factor through a non-injective map. But you have something like a geometric interpretation for the sigma orientation in dimensions congruent to 3 mod 4. So I think that was the overview, and I now start working on the details. First, there is a reminder on the Witten genus. I introduced this as an invariant of spinbordism in dimension 4m, and that is the way it should be. That is supposed to be the primary invariant, what was the invariant before for manifolds of dimension 8, which then led to something interesting for manifolds in dimension 7. Here's going to be the Witten genus for manifolds of dimension 4m, which is going to lead to the secondary construction dimension 4m minus 1. And well, okay, this sheet really, I think, does not contain any information. So the Witten genus is a genus, hence it's given by its characteristic series phi, which is a power series in the Pontryagin numbers, p1 through infinity, with coefficients in wherever the genus takes values, which here are just power series in one variable q over the rational numbers. And then you can just write down this genus by saying it associates with the bordism class of a spin manifold M, this integral over Pontryagin numbers inserted into this power series. And of course, that is not just some dumb power series. It has a number of nice properties. And one of them is that by the Athier-Singh index theorem, this thing, the left-hand side, so this thing is this, which is a priori a power series with rational coefficients. The coefficients are in fact indices of twisted Dirac operators, and I will not dwell on this because it's analysis, but of course I will remark that an index of whatever is always an integer. So I mean, this interpretation tells you that this power series has integer coefficients, and this kappa m is a fudge factor which takes into account the fact that this operator over there, so this Dirac operator actually for m congruent to 3 mod 4 has an additional quaternionic symmetry. So it's always divisible by 2, so we divide by 2 in this case. So it's a fudge factor. I will not mention it again. So, okay. Of course, it's a key property to everything I want to do that if you apply the Witten genus to a string manifold, you do not just get some integral power series, as I explained by the index theorem. You're actually getting the Q expansion of a modular form, that is the upper diagram. And I have to bother you, but just for 2 minutes, you can actually just look away if you don't care for the very, very most detailed account with the explicit form of this characteristic series capital phi. So it's written down here. The most interesting objects appearing are the Eisenstein series, G2K. These M2Ks are just the Newton power series. And okay, that's the power series as indicated. And the only reason I'm displaying this formula is to be able to define phi twiddle. And what you're supposed to see is that phi twiddle is a very minor variation on phi, where in the final exponential you just subtract the constant term and divide by the first Pontryagin number. So this is really the only thing which would be useful to keep in mind, that phi twiddle comes about from phi by dividing by the first Pontryagin number, more or less. Other questions? Oh, here we go. Target group. I could have said that earlier. So this group T2M, where all our invariants take their values, is the quotient of the ring of formal power series with real coefficients by its subring of power series with integer coefficients plus the group of modular forms of weight 2m with real coefficients. And this is, I'm giving this definition at this point because I can more easily motivate it. In the end, we want to construct a Bordism invariant, which looks like this lambda invariant of Milner, but we have to argue it's a Bordism invariant. And as you will see in detail in a minute, these two things in the denominator are exactly the indeterminacies I have to factor out to make my to make what I want to write down a Bordism invariant. The non-trivial thing then is to see that the invariant is not zero. Well, I guess now I'll just write it down. Oh, no. Huh. Okay, here's some more precise reminder on what kind of groups we're actually talking about. So I said not much is known about M-string, about the Bordism group of about string Bordism. I will always concentrate in dimension 4m minus 1. So that is a finite abelian group consisting of 2 and 3 torsion, whereas M-spin in this dimension is a finite F2 vector space, and it is zero for a while, namely up to dimension 35. And then the immediate consequence of the first two items is the third item, this quotient group, which is interesting for us because that is exactly the group where we are not able to easily evaluate our analytically defined invariant. We can easily evaluate it on the subgroup A, and this quotient group is where our analytic invariant is potentially a little mysterious, but in any event, we know this is a finite F2 vector space again, and it is zero for a while. And we do not know a single example where it is non-zero, but this is the refined discussion which I will make at the end. And okay, now how strong is our invariant we are constructing? I mean, we have a precise complete computation, but for now I'm saying we're going to detect all the three torsion and a fair part of the two torsion that is around. I think now we have the actual definition. So this invariant, I'm supposed, so given a 4m minus 1 dimensional closed string manifold M, I'm supposed to write down an invariant of its string Bordism class, and I choose some geometry, so I choose a metric on M, and that gives rise to a distinct differential form representing the spin characteristic class P1 half, and I integrate this as I know I can because I'm on a string manifold. So I get H, and then the invariant I write down is just these two parts which are meant to remind you a little of the analytic expression of Milner's lambda invariant. So the first part is some integral over the manifold, and the second part is some accumulation of eta invariants. So a priori, whatever that is, it is a real power series. And I claim you can prove this lemma, and I actually proved it for you, because now what you need to understand is the variance of this expression under string Bordism. So assume you have M and M prime connected by string Bordism. Pretty generic picture. By string Bordism set, I have to see that this invariant in its target group isn't changed. Well, the first sum is treated via Stokes' theorem as before. You can see everything because Stokes' theorem makes appear dh, which is p1 half, so there is a factor of 2, which makes that p1, and p1 times phi twiddle is phi. So if once you integrate this over set, you get a modular form. So that is why we have to divide out modular forms from our target group. And the second term, under a Bordism, that will vary with according to some index on the manifold set. Whatever that is, it's an integer. So, and since that's why we have to divide out power series with integer coefficients. So this lemma is actually obvious. And okay, the least trivial ingredient in the proof is, of course, what I said about the variation of the eta invariant, but that is Attiah-Patodi-Singer index theorem. Okay, now we can say virtually nothing about this invariant unless we assume we have a spin-zero Bordism. So assume the class of our manifold is contained in the subgroup A. That means it is just zero burdened. Oh, I can make another generic picture. Of course, I only want it to be zero as a spin manifold. If I assumed it was zero as a string manifold, I would be talking about the zero group. Sorry. So, okay, then, just as in Milner's case, the very formula I just gave you simplifies to the formula on the bottom of this page. The first term is unchanged, and the second, for comparison, I can just switch back. This formula has two summons, and these are just the same as the first summon is just unchanged, and the second one, the eta invariance on the boundary M, which are kind of complicated, you have eta invariance on the boundary, but these are just replaced by some characteristic number on the spin manifold. So the characteristic number appearing, or characteristic series, is this power series phi. And that is what is more easily evaluated, not in this form, but in a homotopy theoretic version thereof, which I explain next. Oh, there's another kind of interlude. So I slightly start afresh now, and I want to construct the invariant B top, which in the end is going to be all the same, but first it comes as an independent construction, and I want to motivate this by giving you this one-page construction of Adam's E invariant. So Adam's E invariant is an invariant of stable homotopy classes of the sphere, say X. You have such a class in odd dimension, and you try to understand it through a primary invariant, namely just its MU Hurwitz image. Well, of course, that's a joke, because we all know that MU is evenly graded, so this primary invariant vanishes, and it lifts up to the fiber mu bar. This, of course, says nothing. Mu bar is just as complicated as the sphere, but on mu bar you have an interesting map out, which comes from the complex orientation of complex K theory, mu to K. This easily constructs your map out of mu bar into this K Q mod Z, and in fact that is Adam's E invariant. And the homotopy theoretic construction of our invariant is pretty similar, except that we have some more torsion-free objects around. So it looks like this. We are thinking of our manifold M as defining a map from the sphere into M string, and we try to detect this with some primary invariant, which is the canonical map to M spin. And I mean, by assumption, this is zero, because we're assuming we're in the subgroup. So this list, and I mean, this is totally empty, this part of the diagram. There is nothing happening. The key point, if any, is the construction of an interesting map out of F, which previously came from the complex orientation of K theory. And here, very similarly, it comes from the sigma orientation of M string. Except we have one additional step going to rationals for technical reasons, which I will not belabor. So, but now that is a perfect definition. So this orientation extends to a map of fiber sequences, like as here, and then the second fiber sequence is just rationalized, and the composition up there is A. So now the definition of our invariant B top is just following. You take M, take your manifold, and then the Pontryagin-Thom construction gives you such a map, and you associate with this composition. And it's just a little diagram chase to see that this is well-defined, independent of the choice of set. It is, by the way, not well-defined if you just consider it in the homotopy group of in here, but, okay, this composition, set followed by A is an element in this homotopy, which is immediately computed to be this fellow, so more or less rational power series, modular forms, and this is not well defined independent of the list of set, but once you also mod out integral power series, it is well defined. Okay, then I just state comparison result, which is, I mean, it belabors on the same ideas, though I don't give much of a detail. We know that this purely homotopy theoretic construction I just performed does compute our geometric and hence also the analytic invariant on the subgroup, and it is easy to construct by a very similar homotopy theoretic construction a map out of the homotopy of TMF into our group, factoring E top through the refined Witten genus sigma. So that is a little unfortunate. So it's just, that means factoring blah blah. Oh, that is far away. That means establishing such a commutative diagram, just to remind you. So this invariant is constructed. This invariant has virtually the same construction, so it is obvious that it factors through the Witten genus. Oh, I can make this more obvious in a minute. Okay, from this diagram, it is more than plausible that the invariant I constructed is going to factor somehow through the sigma orientation, because it's just sitting there in the middle. Okay, I hope that is intelligible. Oh, computations. Well, I mean, that is all. We have constructed an invariant which somehow involves non-trivial analysis on string manifolds, E10 variants. We are able to evaluate this on some subgroup, and all that remains to be done now is to explicitly compute this BTMF, which makes sense because we know the homotopy of TMF. And, well, it is in this dimension, the homotopy of TMF in these dimensions is 2 and 3 torsion, so there's a 3 local and a 2 local computation, and the 3 local computation is very easy. Here it is. So there are some remarks in order to start. The homotopy of TMF at the prime 3 is 72 periodic, and our invariant BTMF is sufficiently close to being a TMF module map so that we know that it is compatible with multiplication with the periodicity generator delta cubed. So it's really, to completely evaluate BTMF, it's enough to evaluate it up to dimension 72, and there isn't pretty much. Remember, I'm always talking about just dimension congruent to 3 mod 4. So there are only two groups, two generators, both of order 3, and some computation shows you the power series these fellows map to. So maybe I say a word on this. I mean, how to interpret this two-third delta, where does that live? Delta really means the Q expansion of the classical discriminant, which is a modular form of weight 24 and level 1, and it's a normalized cusp form. So it's a power series starting with Q, and then you have quadratic terms. And this is to be interpreted in this quotient. Oops. And well, okay, I mean, if I didn't put the modular forms here, this quotient would, of course, be trivial to understand. This would be just the product of R mod Z. With the modular forms inside, it's not such an obvious thing anymore, but some very mild arithmetic of modular forms tells you that this element has the largest order it can possibly have, which is 3. I mean, if you multiply this by 3, you have the Q expansion of a modular form, so you're 0. So this is certainly killed by 3. But to say that it is not zero on the nose requires some arithmetic, but it's not so hard, so it's in the paper. And that means, as a consequence, the final line here. BTMF is injective on 3 torsion, because there isn't that much, and every element of order 3 is mapped to an element of order 3, so we detect all the 3 torsion. M24R is the set of power series. It is the R vector space of Q expansion of modular forms of weight 24, tensored with R. Yeah. Did I get the numbers wrong? Where should I?
It depends on the definition of the weight of the model.
Oh, no. I'm not going to. This fellow here has weight 24, and I'm not going to discuss this. But that's not the problem. Oh, okay. I suspect it was more subtle. Yeah, I messed up something. I don't remember. I don't know. Sorry. Yeah, no, you're perfectly right. I don't know. The most up. I mean, where I'm going to go anyway? 7 is. Oh, let me try to rectify this after the talk because I'm just wasting time. I mean. Make some silly mistake, but of course your remark is perfectly correct. If that was true the way it's written, my statement would be false. Actually, I think it's another group. Yeah, you have to figure out the dimensions, and I was just going, oh, it has to be 24, but it's probably something else. But let me just, I mean, there's a fair chance I'm having lots of time left anyway, so then you can press me on all the details. But so the point I was trying to make is we have a computation which is kind of elaborate, but it's standard homotropy theory, so I decided not to display much of it. It's like M pages and Adam spectral sequences and so on. I don't want to say anything about this in detail, in fact, but the result is, for example, in this dimension M is 7, so it's dimension 27. I'm just pretty stupid because it's there. I mean, this has to be just 14, no? Okay, let me look. No. Yeah. As I said, let's try to figure that out in the end. I'm sorry for that. Yeah. You can figure it out more easily because you're sitting down there. Okay. Thanks for pointing this out. I try to get this right in a minute, but the only thing I was trying to say, the answer comes to you as in the form of some power series, and you want to decide what is the order in this group, and that's not totally straightforward, but it's elementary. And in particular, at the prime 3, it tells you that we're detecting everything. BTMF, 3 primary thing, is injective. So at the prime 2, the computation is a little more complicated, and I split up the statement in 2 parts. So this is like a qualitative statement here. So the first result is kind of bad news. Our invariant is going to be 0 in everything in 4th filtration or higher. Here the filtration refers to the filtration defined by the familiar descent spectral sequence computing the homotopy of TMF. This is in fact pretty clear for a priori reasons, which I will not explain. But so at the prime 2, our invariant certainly loses something. Everything which is in filtration 4 and higher, but even looking at filtrations 0 through 3, we detect half of it. So the precise statement is in certain dimensions we are going to have an injection, and in other dimensions it's going to be 0, and all of this makes up for a complete answer because, again, there is a periodicity. But of course this sheet will only give you the full answer if you happen to know the homotopy of TMF at the prime 2 by heart, and if you don't, you can look at this other table, which is the analog of the table I had before. So again, there is a periodicity. This time it's 192. The table displays a complete list of generators we can possibly detect. That means generators of the homotopy in dimension 3 mod 4 up to dimension 192 and discarding everything in filtration 4 or higher. And of these elements, we do in fact detect half. So in the upper part of the table shows a couple of elements which are there, which have various orders up to order 8, and they go somewhere, and all these elements over there, for the same reasoning I messed up a minute before, have the same order. For example, this guy here has order 8. So this is the computational proof of the statement that our invariant is injective up to filtration, modulo filtration 4 in these dimensions. And there are a couple of more generators. They are all of order 2, but we lose them. So they are mapped to 0 under our invariant. And that is just the outcome of the computation. And okay, I will now to start finishing off the talk. I'd like to formulate two problems, or to have a let's just so the most interesting homotropy theoretic problem, which I think is left here, is concerned with this group here. So the kernel of the natural map from string to spin Bordism. So first of all, of course, in a sense, spin Bordism is completely known, at least additively. And I told you that the target group of this homomorphism, M spin in dimension 4, M minus 1, was an F2 vector space, and it's easy to write some computer program computing its dimension, and you see it's 0 for a while, and then it starts growing wildly. I mean, we have no asymptotics or anything, but you just see it becomes a larger and larger space. So the first time we do not a priori know, I mean, of course this tells us that up to dimension 35, our subgroup A is everything because it's the kernel of a group homomorphism into the zero group. And the first time this is not the case anymore is for M equal 10, which is to say in dimension 39, then the target is the one-dimensional F2 vector space. So we could have a subgroup of index 2, and there you can still use results of Mohowald and Gobunov to compute the map J through the Adam spectral sequence and see that in fact this homomorphism is still zero. So the subgroup is everything, and in general we just don't know anything about this. I mean, it is somehow okay. For general M, there is the following alternative, which needs explanation. It's the diagram you've seen before, except for the vertical arrow. So the alternative is just the following. Either we may have equality here for all M, which is just to say the canonical map from string to spin Bordism should be zero in these dimensions. I wouldn't see any reason for this. I mean, if this is true, there must be some nice homotropy theoretic argument for this, but I don't see it. And it is, I even don't know what to believe. At least the target groups into which these homomorphisms go seem to grow rapidly. So if I was to believe in statistics or something, I would rather guess that at some point this is not an equality anymore. But if it is, it's certainly some nice remark or result in homotopy theory. So either this is true, then this requires some nice proof, or it is false, and then for some M, this means geometrically that there is going to be a string manifold which is not zero-bordened as a spin manifold. And then the interesting question, then there arises an interesting question of a completely different nature, namely whether or not this triangle commutes. You see, on this, assume you do have a high-dimensional string manifold which does not bound a spin manifold. We still have our analytically defined invariant, which involves this complicated eta invariant, and there is no way you're going to evaluate this explicitly. But we also have the sigma orientation and this homotopy theoretically constructed invariant BTMF, which we know almost always agree, but I mean, for a string manifold which does not bound a spin manifold, we do not know this. So if there is such a thing, then it becomes a nice analytic question if these two invariants still agree. We can answer nothing of this, but I mean, I'll just formulate this as an open problem, and I think this actually, there are no more sheets here, so thank you very much for your attention. Say it again. No, I understood. Why do you need to write delta?
Right, but it's in the invariant, it's still not
outside. Oh, that is. I mean, you're not entitled to refer to anything on this blackboard. I screwed up completely. I mean.
Yeah. But I think it's 28.
Okay, Mark already rectified it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Raj. Oh, then, okay. So that makes sense. And, okay, again, that is, so I wanted to say, this element is obviously killed by 3. I gave the wrong reason. The reason it is obviously killed by 3 is that delta has an integral Fourier expansion. I just told you the wrong things because I messed up anyway, sorry. So this element is certainly killed by 3 because if you multiply it by 3, you have an integral power series. So it lands into this subgroup, not into this one. And saying that it is not 0 on the nose is actually... Oh no, that is not entirely trivial because it says you cannot add to this Q expansion anything integral to make it the Q expansion of something in weight 28. Is that obvious? No. That is not the Q expansion principle because you have forms of different weight. So that is the small arithmetic thing you have to do there. Does that answer your question? Okay, thanks. So you're saying some of the invariants are factoring through MO or what? Is that what you're saying?
I want to change the string
function. Of what? Of M or of the zero borders?
M.
You want to change the string structure. And you're saying it's obvious that this is invariant then?
Because of your diagram, you have the Lippmann series. Lippmann series is only, you can write down some of the algebraic class, that doesn't depend on it.
But not in these dimensions 4m minus 1, can you?
That means 4m minus 1.
That is somehow the trick. I mean, we're given a geometric interpretation to the sigma orientation in an odd dimension, where, I mean, there's. I can't answer this. I don't know. But that's not an answer. So I said, it's not clear to me. I mean, I would be really surprised if it didn't. But since it's not completely injective, I can't tell often. In the definition? Oh, there's not going to be seen much, but I can do this. Yeah, that is the dependence. That is up here actually. And that goes into here. Does that answer? Yeah, I cannot answer this offhand because I never thought about it and it's not sufficiently injective. I mean, I just don't know how much you can move around an element in string borderism by altering the string structure on the same manifold. If I knew that was transitive in some dimension, say, then you would be done immediately because our invariant is injective, and I could say, no, it has to depend on the string structure. But I just don't know. But actually, I do know this because when you get older, you like the special cases. Pi 3, that is, I mean, 3 is 4 times 1 minus 1. And in fact, I mean, there everything comes, I mean, from the stable stem of a sphere, it's order 24, and you can represent it represent everything, in fact, in the stable stem, and a fortiori in the homotopy of M string, So M string in dimension 24, that is set mode 24, and you can in fact represent every element using suitable string structures on the 3 sphere. And thank you very much. That was already contradicting my assertion about small dimensions. Yeah, and we check in the paper as an example that you can represent every class in this group by using a suitable string structure on the three sphere, and since we detect everything here, the answer must be no. The invariant must depend on the string structure, because otherwise it couldn't be injective here. That one? Yeah.
Are these ones that you're detecting by this invariant, are they all in Adams Novikov concentration form? Like mu delta, like delta is already mentioned, and Adams Novikov coefficient zero, and mu is a delta.
I don't remember. I would have to look at the chart, because as I wisely confessed, I don't know the charts by heart. Unlike you, so Eugene can just tell me. Okay, we have. I mean, this in the middle column, these are the standard names. So I would actually guess it's all Adams Novikov filtration one. Yeah. But that would be poor. I mean, I would remember this. And we have to look at. I don't have to look at the charts. I don't know.
I was trying to figure it out.